you know, the world is a mess right now. I mean, people are doing anything they can to get their physical needs met, whether it's war or strife, and even their psychological needs. I think physical changes are important. But until the world gets a psychological change, some change that comes from within that says, you know, we don't have to club the guy next to us to get ours. Until people in the world learn that, we're going to continue to have war and strife and stuff like that.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode,
cooking up gods,
doing spirituality the atheist way,
and the third dimension of woo.
All coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington.
Hello, Kim.
Hi, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm enjoying my secular Christmas season. I have my house all decorated. Very fun. I've got wreaths everywhere. They're my favorite actual decoration because, well, I love the tree too. But with the wreaths, you can just leave them decorated and packed up. And so I just toss them on hooks on the wall and suddenly my house looks festive.
Very nice.
Very efficient that way.
This is the second year we don't have a Christmas tree. And the reason is, we normally had one, but the reason is our kids are just so damn lazy. And we asked the kids before, we were on our way out of the house to get the Christmas tree last year, and the kids are like, I don't want to go. We're like, come on, this is the family thing. We're going to get the tree. We're going to pick it out. I don't want to. So we're like, okay, fine. We're not getting a tree then. Is that what you want? They're like, yeah, as long as we could stay here and watch TV. And we said, good. So this year, we asked them again. We said, look, do you want a tree? And if you do want a tree, we have to come pick it out, and you have to help decorate it. You know, we're all doing this together. And they just didn't want to do it. But next year, Christmas is going to be at our house, like the family comes, the extended family, and we're going to be having a large Christmas party, like a neighborhood and friends and family. So we're definitely getting a tree and we're going to do it, but not this year.
Okay, I'm putting those dates down. I'm coming up.
You'll be invited.
Excellent.
All right, so who are we talking to today, Kim?
Today we have Mark W. Gura. He is someone I met, oh gosh, I can't remember when I met him. I know he was at DragonCon this year. We were both at the Carolina Secular Conference, the Atheist Alliance, lots of fun places. He is the host of Blind Faith Vaccine Show, and he's also the author of Atheist Meditation Against Spirituality.
Awesome. All right, well, let's get him on the line. And Kim and I have the pleasure of speaking with Mark W. Gura. How you doing, Mark?
Hey, Bo. How you doing?
Doing awesome.
All right, Mark. I have the first question for you today. I think that a lot of the secular community would say that meditation is just a whole bunch of woo, it's pseudoscience, it's malarkey. What do you have to say to this?
Well, I think the suspicions are very legitimate, and I think there is a lot of wooey, malarkey-like meditation techniques out there, and I think a lot of them do subscribe to worshiping gods, to pseudoscience, to the supernatural, and even to guruism, you know, and so I'm totally with that. I think atheists, secularists should be very, very careful as to which meditation techniques they practice. Now, what we know based on scientific experiments is that meditation does decrease stress. I mean, there's not that much controversy about that. It decreases depression. It decreases dissatisfaction. You know, we have scientific studies that show this. It can improve working memory. It can improve unproductive mental patterns, reduce anxiety. Some studies have even shown that it reduces cortisol and DHE, so it can even slow the aging process. And, you know, the first few things that I mentioned, those are very psychological things. So meditation does take care of those psychological aspects of things. But other studies also show us that meditation actually makes physical changes in the brain. So someone who's been meditating for a long, long period of time, their brain looks different physically because certain tissues, there's an increase in tissues in the area of the brain that maintain attention and controlling impulses. There are thicker tissues in the area responsible for body awareness. There are stronger connections between various brain areas. There's also a reduction in the size and the region that's linked to sadness and anxiety. And And there's also reduced activity in the region responsible for pain. So it's actually a physical thing that happens when we meditate. The important thing is to stay away from techniques that are supernatural based, that refer to gods, gurus, and pseudoscience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good advice. So let's go back a little bit and talk about your story. Why did you want to learn to meditate? When did this whole thing start?
You know, sometimes I think of my story as almost like that movie, you know, Live, Love, Pray. Except, you know, here you have a guy who at one time believed in God, you know, was searching for God and traveling around the world looking for meaning and God and then became an atheist. Yeah, so I remember when I was a child, you know, when I was a young child, the first time when I was really young, I felt this freedom, this happiness, and I'm sure some of us can relate to this. And then at one time, I mean, it was close to what, you know, the Buddhists call equanimity, right? When we're children, we're just kind of in that space, that free space. And then I remember, you know, school started and responsibility started, and it was almost as if society, culture were programming me, conditioning me to feel that it's not okay just to be happy, that happiness had to have specific reasons. And so the very next time that I felt that freedom was in high school. And at that time I had learned, you know, I knew that meditation existed, but I thought, well, who needs meditation? I mean, I've got, you know, I'm partying, I'm having a great time. And, you know, when I smoked pot, I felt equanimous. And when I tripped on acid, I got insights. And when I drank, I felt confident, determined. And when I did X, I loved everyone, you know, compassion, all those things that supposedly meditation gives you. And I thought, well, I didn't need meditation. But then the problem is, after a while, everyday reality started to suck. I mean, I noticed that it sucks. And a lot of people think and will agree with me that on some level, reality kind of sucks. So I became jaded. I tended to hold other people responsible for my feelings. And I'm not saying don't have fun. I love to have fun. But it was obvious that at that time I was self-medicating. And you know, see, the constant fun that I was experiencing was not sustainable. And so I figured that, you know, maybe what I needed was more money and time, right? And so then I started to work on attaining financial success. And as I did that, as I started to work on it, I realized that inner suffering continued. So then I thought, well, maybe I'm not being altruistic enough. Maybe I need to do more volunteer work. And I did that, and that didn't help. So then I thought, well, maybe I should go to church and become religious. And so at that point, I accepted Jesus into my heart. And I even thought that he spoke to me, you know. Now I know that it was my own mind, me speaking to myself within my own mind. But at the time, you know, I thought it was Jesus.
Or the ecstasy.
But still, I experienced that suffering. And so then I thought, well, maybe I'm going to the wrong church. You know, maybe it's Christianity. Maybe I need to look into the other religions. Maybe I need to go to so I started to going to temples, centers, all these different places, and reading all the major religious books and philosophies. I even got into the self-help system and almost become certified as a therapist. But then I realized that I couldn't help myself. I was still suffering. I felt bad. So why would I work on other people? And I thought, well, maybe this is just a local problem. Maybe what's happening is I'm just not tapping into the greatest of all gurus and teachers and stuff like that. And so I decided, you know, I want to travel around the world. I want to meet all the personalities out there that are making great changes. I want to get that transmission. I sold everything I had. I gave everything away that I could. And I traveled the world for 3 years. I met people like Mother Teresa and the Dalai Lama. And at the end of it all, I realized, you know what, this is not an external problem. This is an internal problem. It's a psychological thing that we can all work on. And this is really how I came across meditation. I found this mindfulness meditation center in India, and it wasn't quite exactly secular. It was a meditation system called Vipassana that was taught by the late S.M. Goenka. And he was really big about, you know, no guru, student relationships, you know, you didn't need to believe in a god or supernatural beliefs or, you know, stuff like that to practice the meditation. And so the way I learned meditation was just meditating like 10, 12, 14 hours a day, in courses that were like 10 days, 10-day courses, 20-day courses. They even have longer courses. And so, you know, I would sit in these little rooms with myself, no speaking during the whole time. And it's really the first time that I met myself, because up until that point, I'd just been, you know, any time something internal happened that wasn't comfortable, I would distract my attention from that with something else, something external. So once I learned how to go within, changes started to happen within me, and my internal suffering eased. I started to gain access to my unconscious motivations, and I didn't even need a therapist to do it. You know, I learned how to calm down the mind, and I became more confident. Some of my baggage lessened, you know, and a lot of the childhood stuff, you know, went away. And, you know, as bad as you might think I am right now, I was much worse before that. So that's really how I came across meditation. But now when I look back at it, you know, the world is a mess right now. I mean, people are doing anything they can to get their physical needs met, whether it's war or strife, and even their psychological needs. And now that I look back at it, I think physical changes are important. But until the world learns gets a psychological change, some change that comes from within that says, you know, we don't have to club the guy next to us to get ours. Until people in the world learn that, we're going to continue to have war and strife and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm a big believer in meditation at this point.
Mark, I got to ask you something. When you were talking, I was thinking about some of the conversations that I had with some religious friends. And the religious friends would tell stories very similar to yours. Like they're always searching for something and they weren't quite finding it. They're trying all these different things. And then they usually eventually settle on Christianity, of course, because it's the religion of our culture and they're in this culture. So that's what they settle on. But when I tell my story or when I think of myself and put myself in that position, I don't have those kind of needs. I never had that kind of desperation, that kind of search, and like not knowing who I was and trying all these different things. And I don't think a lot of people have that. I think a lot of people pretty much maybe they're comfortable with who they are and they don't go through the searching process, so they don't need religion. And therefore, I would ask you this: is this something like maybe people don't need meditation either?
Well, there are two forms of meditation. There is secular meditation and there's religious meditation. The difference is that religious meditation draws on religious symbolism, religious words, religious concepts, and it reinforces a certain belief system that's based on the supernatural. And then there are secular techniques that use universal things such as breath, and that don't require beliefs, don't require supernaturalism. So let's make sure we understand that. So what that really means is that an atheist, a secularist, can practice meditation without being woolly, without being pseudoscientific, because all this stuff is based on science. It's proven by science, and you know, doesn't have to practice anything religious. And now, as far as are there people out there who need something deeper? I think there are.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm here with Kimberly Ellington, and we're speaking with author Mark W. Gura about atheist meditation.
All the religions of the world speak to that. I mean, let's take Buddhism, for example. Buddhism is the third largest religion right now, and there are millions and millions of Buddhists. I forget what the latest figure is right now. Most people don't realize that Buddhism does not need a creator, doesn't believe in a creator God. Okay, traditional Buddhism does not believe in a creator God, but traditional Buddhism does have problems. It believes in spirits. It believes in deities that are superhero-like entities that have some sort of supernatural reincarnation type of aspect to them, and it also takes on a lot of different cultural beliefs. So most atheists and secularists don't want to practice Buddhism. And yet, if the secular community doesn't offer something like meditation in a secular way, then people who are secular, who are atheists, who want to stay away from Wu, have very few choices. They have very few choices because the only people that are teaching meditation in some cases are traditional Buddhists. So not only do we need, as a secular movement, do we need to emphasize the fact that there are places where people who have deeper needs, that they can go to secular places, but we also need to emphasize that a lot of the Buddhists out there, And some of the Buddhists out there don't even believe in the supernatural. They don't believe in any kind of gods, not even the type of gods with a small g. And so they're really secularist as well. And that's why, you know, I'm the executive director of the Mindfulness Meditation, of the Association of Mindfulness Meditation, and we're starting a website called theskepticsguidetomeditation.com, and it's going to show secular people where to go, centers that are not secular, that are not, you know, supernatural-based or guru-based or teach woo or pseudoscience.
Now, I'm fascinated because I read Eat, Pray, Love. And mostly it made me hungry. Folks, if you haven't read this book, she like essentially just talks about all the food she eats across Italy and India, and I think Indonesia. But one of the things that she described was trying to get to that. I don't think she necessarily used the word nirvana, but to a place, but she was trying, her goal was in her meditation to feel this power and sense of oneness with the universe, and that actually sounded kind of interesting to me. I've heard a few talks on essentially transcendence and secular transcendence. Is this something that you've achieved, or is this something that secularists can kind of look toward?
Well, you know, to truly understand what meditation is, it's important to understand altered states of consciousness. Okay, and because there, you know, science is does not fully understand consciousness yet, but we do understand a few things, you know, based on studies that have been done. Okay, so basically, what happens is roughly, the brain perceives about 11 million bits of information per second, and the intellect is conscious of between 16 and 50 bits of information per second. So what happens to all that other information that we perceive but we're not perceiving? Well, throughout the ages, in modern history, that's been called the unconscious mind or the subconscious mind. And I don't want to imply any sort of, you know, mind-body dualism with this. I don't want to imply anything supernatural with this. This is a psychological thing. And, you know, every child knows that throughout the day we go through different states of consciousness. You know, when we're, right now, we're talking, we're reasoning, we're in our everyday conscious state of awareness. And everyone knows that there are those times when we go into that space, that altered state of consciousness where, like, let's say we're driving somewhere and all of a sudden we're there. So where were we? You know, we were present, we were awake, we were doing things, but we kind of spaced out, right? And then there's also that that space where, you know, when we're watching a great movie or having great sex or using drugs or alcohol, and we go into that altered state of consciousness. So there is that, the everyday consciousness, there is the altered state of consciousness, and then there's sleep. And in ancient times, I think people didn't understand that these three states of being were normal, natural human states of being. They thought that when they went into that altered state of consciousness, that they were actually communing with some sort of higher power or God or something like that. Now, we now know scientifically that that's probably not the case. There's no proof whatsoever that that's the case, but we know that the mind does this naturally. So people who didn't know science mystified and supernaturalized this natural state of being. And, you know, you might ask, well, you know, how do we know that these states exist? Well, the mind, we can measure electrical activity in the brain. You know, we can use an EEG machine and measure electrical impulses. So if you were to put an EEG machine on us right now in our everyday state of being, it would basically register between 14 and 35 hertz per second. Once we start processing information and learning something, the mind slows down, the brain slows down a little bit, goes down to about 27 hertz. When we go into that altered state of consciousness that's normally called meditation, it brainwave activity reduces to about 8 to 13 hertz. And then when we go into that state of being that's kind of like right before we fall asleep, but we're still kind of in a meditative state, that's about 4 to 7 hertz. And that state produces dreams. It produces a dreamlike state, but yet we're still aware. And so I can totally see how the ancients would have been in that state of being and would have thought that they're talking to God or they're talking to ghosts or spirits or whatever it is. They didn't know science. And they didn't know that they were just making guesses based on dreams that they were having,
right,
you know?
Right.
So it's no wonder that these religions formed around this type of thing. And you know, why do people want to have that deeper feeling? I mean, let's face it. Look, our consciousness is a new evolutionary development. You know, before we were human, before we were fully conscious like we are right now, we were in that altered state of consciousness all the time. And now all of a sudden we have this new brain that is able to reason. And being able to reason and perceive things hurts. It hurts to know that you're going to die one day. It hurts to know that you might not be appealing to some people, that some people just might not like you for whatever reason. And, you know, we hurt for a variety of different reasons. And some people are lucky enough in life to have a childhood that basically is just so good that they never experience any problems. But other people, like myself, have this need to transcend some of the, you know, things that have happened in life and search for that place that's more peaceful within. And, you know, we can do it by just there are very few mechanisms that give this new evolutionary development, this consciousness, that release. And that includes sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It also includes meditation. And, you know, I think the advertising industry has totally realizes what these altered states of consciousness are, because one of the negatives of an altered state of consciousness is that we're more suggestible when we're in an altered state of consciousness. So if you watch a commercial or listen to a song or watch TV and it puts you in that altered state of consciousness, as it always does when it's good enough, you stop to reason. You're sitting back in that state of relaxation, and messages are coming into your mind. And we all know that statement that if something's heard long enough, we start to believe it. When we're not reasoning, when we're not qualifying information, comparing it to the data bank of information that we have from our experience, then we start to believe it. And that's why altered states of consciousness can be very dangerous.
Right.
And that's why that's also why it's important to know how to go into an altered state of consciousness and find out what you've been programmed with and cut all that stuff out.
Right. You know what that reminds me of, Mark? Whenever I have a dream, not whenever, but a lot of times when I do have a dream, and it's a dream, let's say my wife is being a jerk to me in my dream, and I wake up, I'm mad at my wife, and I'm completely conscious,
yeah,
and I know it's completely unreasonable, but I still have that like deep inner emotional anger going on toward my wife because of this dream. And it just goes to show you the power of just like the mind and the unconscious, as you're talking about, and that altered state of consciousness.
Yeah, and this is why it's so important, and I love the fact that our community is so supportive of reason. I mean, it's reason and science that helps us determine whether some of our hypotheses are really true or not. I mean, this is why I'm an atheist, because I realize in studying all these different religions that, you know what, all these ideas, all these religions, all these thoughts about spirits being real and afterlives and all this stuff, these are just ideas. Yeah. But there's not a shred of evidence that they're real. These are just ideas. They're hypotheses. They're not even scientific hypotheses.
Sure, sure. And as you mentioned before, if you don't understand the scientific, the biological, the psychological, all the factors that are going on, then you jump to what you do understand. And generally what everybody understands, or what they think they understand, is the mythology that they grew up with, or the cultural themes, and then they kind of adopt those and turn those into reality. So if you don't know about these altered states of consciousness and how your mind plays tricks on you, then you automatically assume, let's say you're Christian, you assume the Christian God. You assume like you're talking to Jesus. Like I found it very interesting when you were telling your story, you were saying that you really did believe you were talking to Jesus, right? You were hearing from Jesus.
That's right. Well, you know, Bo, this brings me back to the question you asked earlier. You know, let's face it, religion conditions us as children, and it tells us that certain things are true. And usually most people wind up accepting their cultural norms. And that's why most of the people in the Middle East are Muslim, and most of the people in India are Hindu, and most of the people in the United States and Alabama are Christian, right? So from the beginning, we're conditioned and programmed to believe certain things. Very few people step out of the box and go, wait a minute, are my beliefs true? But most people in life wind up going through some sort of crisis situation sooner or later, or some situation where they feel like, you know, I need to find meaning in life. I need to find out, you know, what is it all about? What do I want to achieve with this life? And when that happens, if our secular community doesn't have secular options such as meditation and meanings and purpose work, if we don't have that available to our people in our secular communities, those people are going to go to woolly, pseudoscientific, supernatural places, and they're going to learn from those places. They're going to get vested interest in those places after a while, because they're going to devote time and money to those places, and then we've lost them one more time. So as the secular community, we're losing people twice. We're losing them when they're children, and then we're losing them when they have crises in their lives, because we don't give them the tools that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing very important that the secular community is starting to understand, is that we need to provide alternatives to people's needs when they're usually going after religion. So we have to look at religion and look at all the things that religion offers people. And that could be hope, it could be purpose, it could be whatever. And we have to provide a secular alternative to that. And if we don't, just as you say, people will start going to religion or pseudoscience or woo or whatever, because we don't have a good secular alternative. So I guess going back to that, you were talking about meditation and how it does fill this need, and I think you did kind of admit that this isn't a need that everybody necessarily has, but it is a need that many people have. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, when I do seminars about this thing, when I'm in a room full of atheists, not too many people raise their hand and say, yeah, you know, I have this need. I've had this need in my life. And that makes me wonder, too, like, okay, so where are those people that had this need? Are they just not in this room? Are they not in our secular atheistic community because they've been snapped up by the Buddhists,
the traditional
good question. Buddhists, or they, by some other form of, traditional religion? I mean, here's the thing. Religion really has four components to it, okay? And we, as atheists, we fill three of those components. Right now, we're doing almost zero on the fourth. Okay, so the four components are this. Okay, religion has theology, which really is a fancy word for worldview. Okay, and this worldview is based on history. It's based on psychology, but it's also based on mythology, pure unadulterated mythology, and it's also based on rites and rituals. And we have something better. We have a worldview that's based on reason and science. So I think we trump religion in this, and that's why education is our friend. And the more that people find out that we have a superior worldview, the more people are going to join us. That's great. We have that. Altruism. Okay. Religion for thousands of years has been doing altruistic things, helping people. Some say that it does that for its own gain. Others say that it does that out of the kindness of its heart. It doesn't matter. Religion has this, but we have this too. Atheists, secularists, humanists, we do altruistic things too. We've got that. Okay. Religion has community. We're catching up to this. Religion has had thousands of years to build communities. We're catching up. We have community too. But then religion has spirituality, and we don't have that. Okay, we don't have spirituality. But what does spirituality mean? You know, when we do studies on people who say that they're in a spiritual state of mind, and we put that EEG thing on them, they're experiencing 4 to 13 hertz cycles on an EEG machine. So they're in an altered state of consciousness. Now, how they define what's happening to them, that's the part that becomes supernatural or religious or whatever. But we know that it's an altered state of consciousness, and it doesn't have to be achieved using beliefs, religious beliefs, supernatural beliefs. So in other words, the state of wonder that we're all familiar with is an altered state of consciousness. It's 4 to 13 hertz cycles on an EEG machine. Okay? Altered state of consciousness means accessing the unconscious mind. Accessing the unconscious mind equals meditation. And meditation equals secular spirituality. And the reason I say secular spirituality, because we want to differentiate. We want people to know that we're not talking about spiritualism. We're talking about an altered state of consciousness, and every human being can achieve that. And see, religion has monopolized this for a very particular reason. Because it's a very powerful thing. Every single culture, every single person has achieved an altered state of consciousness. But religion has convinced us that only religious people are allowed to have this. And we atheists have been stupid enough to let them hold on to this monopoly. We've allowed them we've respected their monopoly. And we've said, yeah, you're right. You know, we're not spiritual. We can't be secularly spiritual. You can have that. Well, we've just given them the most powerful tool that they can ever have. starting from childhood to when a person has a crisis in their life. Because when a person has a crisis in their life, they need to get in touch with their inner selves. They need to get in touch with who they are, what they want to achieve in this life, and be able to release that stress that occurs when we're conscious, when we experience reason. And meditation is the way to do it.
I feel like we probably have 1 or 2 or 100 listeners out there who are thinking to themselves, okay, this sounds like a whole lot of woo right now.
Okay, and so tell me what that means.
It sounds like, because just using the word spirituality, it's I hate the word trigger, but it's a trigger word for a lot of former religious people.
Well, it has the word spirit in it.
It has the word spirit, right? The spirituality, that's immediately the, I think as a community generally, we see spirituality as 180 degrees from reason and logic. So,
you're right.
Yeah. So to those folks right now, I think you've made some really good points about the scientificness of it. Why do you think that the spirituality is the missing piece for the atheist?
Okay. Well, first of all, let's agree on a few things or disagree on a few things. Okay. So first of all, is there such a thing as altered state of consciousness? Based on what we know scientifically. Okay. So is it true that when they say that they're being spiritual, religious people, they enter into the same exact state that an atheist enters when they're experiencing wonder? In other words, the hertz per second, the 4 to 13 hertz per second state of being. It's we can measure that. So we're experiencing the same thing as religious people are experiencing when we enter that state, whatever we want to call it. So now the question is, what do we call that state? Okay. Yeah, religious people call it spirituality, and they, not only do they call it spirituality, but they equate them communicating with God when they're in that state, okay, or demons or devils or spirits or whatever it is, right? So, and they did that initially in the history, throughout history, because they really thought that they were entering some third dimension of woo, right? But we now know that that's probably not true.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm here with Kimberly Ellington, and we're speaking with author Mark W. Gura about atheist meditation.
You know, we know that atheists can enter that state. We don't believe in anything. We're conscious enough to know we're not communing with any kind of God or any kind of spirit, right? So now the question is, what do we call that state? I mean, yeah, we can call it wonder. We can call it a state of wonder. We can call it whatever we want. But if we don't, at least somehow let the world know that we too are able to enter that state, then, we get what we got when Oprah stood up there and said, oh, yeah, atheists aren't able to access spirituality. This is something only religious people can have.
I'm an atheist, I'm a secularist, and if I'm thinking to myself right now, okay, spirituality, I've never had that, or I've had it and I don't want that anymore. So how do I safely go about finding a way to meditate that isn't going to try to lead me back into woo? Where do I start?
Okay. Well, there. First of all, it's important to know that there are two types of meditation. There's religious meditation and there is secular meditation. So, an atheist, a secularist, needs to stay away with all wooey techniques that refer to anything that has anything to do with gods, gurus, the supernatural, or pseudoscience. Okay, so that's the first step. Second step, it's important to understand that there are two ways to enter into a meditative state. We can enter into an altered state of consciousness in a purposeful way or a spontaneous way. So spontaneous altered states of consciousness happen to us every day anyway. Okay. So as an atheist, you don't really have to learn a formal meditation technique. You can just continue to do what you're doing. It's very easy. It happens all the time. When you go to a camp and you stare into a fire, you're going to enter an altered state of consciousness if you look into the fire long enough. So that's the pro of that is that it's very easy to do. the con of entering into spontaneous states of consciousness is that they leave us open to be conditioned. Anytime you're in an altered state and your reasoning goes away and you're just enjoying yourself sitting back, any messages that are around you tend to kind of seep in because you're not qualifying them. You're not comparing them to your data bank of experience. So some of it could be conditioning you. The other thing is it's not easy to interpret the messages you get from the unconscious part of the mind, you know, that part of the mind that you're not immediately aware of. So it's not the best way to access altered states of consciousness. If you really want to get the full benefit of altered states of consciousness, learn some sort of meditation technique that's not religious. And the benefits of that is meditation, I mean, it's been shown, helps rewire the brain. I mean, neuroplasticity occurs for everyone, even when we're not meditating, but meditation heightens it. Therefore, meditation can free us from unwanted instinctual reactions and limitations because we're accessing things that we normally don't have access to in a purposeful way. It gives us the ability to observe, those unconscious processes. It helps us overwrite our brain's bias towards pessimism if we're using the right kind of technique, and to evaluate our cultural conditioning and stuff like that. But once we know that there are those forms of meditation, you might ask, well, there are millions of forms of meditations out there. How do I know what's what, right? And basically, we can classify all the other meditation techniques that exist out there into like four different categories. Okay, so there are basically four categories of meditation: guided meditation, visual meditation, auditory meditation, and mindfulness/kinesthetic meditation. And so it's important for atheists and the secular community to understand those four types of meditation and to stay away from certain ones. So, for example, guided meditation is when some other person or a computer or a recorded message or music or a brainwave synchronizer or affirmations or something puts you in an altered state of consciousness. The pro of that is it's very easy. You just follow. But the con of this is that someone or something else is directing your mind. And that's straight out hypnosis. I mean, this is exactly what religion does to children in the beginning and throughout people's lives. It's basically using words and guiding you to believe certain things. So I'm very much against guided meditation. Maybe in some cases, if you're doing it for yourself and you know how you're guiding yourself, like maybe using a recording or something like that, or just to learn. But I think we should be very weary of those types of meditations. And most of the wooey techniques out there are guided meditations. Then there's visual meditation. Visual meditation is when you're using some sort of external visual cue or internal visual cue to put yourself in an altered state of consciousness. And once again, this is religion loves and pseudoscience and supernatural loves these techniques where they use visual representations that link back to their religion in some way and then condition you that way. So I stay away from visual meditation. Same thing with auditory meditations. It's using words or phrases or, to basically enter into an altered state of consciousness. The meditation techniques that I think are safest for atheists and secularists are mindfulness or kinesthetic type meditation. And the reason mindfulness is powerful is because you're using like the breath or the sensations of the body, something that's very neutral, something that doesn't link back to religion and or pseudoscience or anything else in any way. And I think if we know that and then combined with maybe websites, like the ones that we're creating right now that point people to secular meditation centers and products and stuff like that, then I think we have an educated way of learning meditation, and we don't wind up buying into wooey techniques.
Right, right. You know what, Mark? All this talk of guided meditation and conditioned responses reminds me so much of my upbringing in Catholic Church. And I just want to play this little comedy clip that I heard the other day. It's really funny. It's John Mulaney talking about a conditioned response example.
I grew up Catholic. I don't go to church anymore, but I went on Christmas Eve with my parents, because you know how you lie to your parents. So we go into the church, and I was like, I got this under control. And then I got schooled because they introduced a bunch of new shit. No, I was going through Mass and I was batting like 400. And then in the middle of Mass, the priest said, "Peace be with you." And everyone said, "And with your spirit." And I was like the one pre-Y2K asshole going, "And also with you." What? Huh? What? Huh? What? When? What? For those of you that aren't Catholic, I don't mean to exclude you, even though we love to exclude you, but there's a part in church where the priest says, "Peace be with you," and for many, many years, we all said,
"And also with you."
Very good. But they changed it to "and with your spirit," because that's what needed revamping in the Catholic Church. And that was the squeaky wheel that needed the grease.
My little girl, who, when she was in second and third grade in public school, she would actually describe some of her friends as seeming like they were hypnotized, because they would just be her friend. They would just be playing, and then they would suddenly, like, literally turn into little robots, is how she described it. And they'd be like, "And have you discovered the Lord? Is Jesus Christ your friend?" And then they would go back and play again. It creeped her out, quite honestly. Yeah. That probably did more to keep her away from organized religion than anything else so far.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't sit through church anymore. I mean, because, you know, it's an outright lie. I mean, not only, well, first of all, the classic definition of hypnosis is altered state plus someone piping messages into your mind, right? And that's exactly what church does. But even if it didn't do that, the priest or whoever the leader of that religious organization is outright lies. I mean, they say information that's not a fact, and they present it as fact. So, yeah, between those two, we abuse our children by conditioning and programming them as a society from day one. And then on top of it, we don't give people tools so that they can free themselves of the conditioning and the programming, because, see, meditation is an antidote to that.
Yeah.
Because it gives you the tools personally to figure out how you've been conditioned, rather than just leaving it up to spontaneous
methods. Okay, and that's actually, like, I think a really important point right here, because I'm kind of trying to think from a skeptic's point of view, and my thought has been through this whole thing, why do we have to do what religion does? Why do we have to do exactly like they do? Mm. Are we actually feeding into this by saying, well, they have spirituality, so, oh, look, we have spirituality too? But what you just said about using meditation and mindfulness as a tool to handle all of these things ourselves, I think that's a pretty important point, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, snake venom will kill us, right? But if we use just a little bit of it, it works like an antidote. And that's you know, we're not doing the same thing that religion is doing. We are not telling people that altered state of consciousness equals supernatural talking to God and spirits. We're not saying that. Quite the opposite. We're saying, no, you're just experiencing a psychological state of being that's normal and natural to everyone. Hmm. And we're giving people access to their own mind so that they can recondition their own mind and not be conditioned by the BS that they've experienced in society.
Well, Mark, let me play devil's advocate for a moment here. And if somebody were to say, well, Mark, maybe you're saying that you don't communicate with God when you're in this state, and you're saying that it's something else, but I'm telling you it's God. So what is your evidence that it's not God? What would you say to that?
Well, it's a beautiful question, too, because it basically goes back to, you know, what is an atheist? And, you know, an atheist isn't a person that has proof that there is no God. An atheist is a person who basically doesn't have enough belief to believe in a God. So, you know, we might not be able to prove that that person's not talking to God, but they can't prove that they are. Therefore, we're atheistic to that idea. Yeah. We don't believe in that idea because no proof has been presented to us.
Right.
Look, you know, I'm the first one. You know, if a God showed up tomorrow, I'd be like, great, you know, whatever. I believe in him. But there's no proof. So if someone cooks up some idea about some God or some spirit or some reincarnation or whatever, that's a great idea, but they have not a shred of proof for it. So therefore, I don't have to believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. It comes down to the burden of proof, essentially. If somebody's telling you that they're communicating with God, we're not saying anything about it, you're telling me that it's a God, I'm not saying anything about it, then you have the burden of proof to tell me that it's a God. And just like everybody else who claims that it's another God or another being or aliens, everybody else, they've got the burden of proof to prove that to you, rather than us trying to prove that, no, it's not a God, or it's not Elvis Absolutely. Presley coming back from the dead. And the other thing that I would say to that too, and I would ask people who insist they're speaking or communicating with a God or with an angel or a guardian angel or any kind of being, I would insist that they think about this and ask themselves, if you are speaking or communicating with another being, what information are you getting that you couldn't get on your own? And that's the big question, because, you know, everybody comes back and says, well, you know what, I talked to God and God said to love each other, and, you know, all these platitudes that we see on Facebook 100 times a day, or we hear all the time. And this isn't new information. This is something we all know. And I think that's what people say too. You know, it's like, bring us something new. If you are a God, if you are an alien, advanced alien race, a being, if you are my dead grandmother, tell me something that I couldn't know on my own. Tell me something that only you could tell me, and convince me that you are a being. But this has never happened.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Great
I wonder,
point.
I'm kind of thinking now, though, if we get in touch, who knows what's in our subconscious, right? So yeah. There might be a few folks that they might just need to stay away from that.
Right. Well, that's a good point, Kim. I mean, we have a lot of buried things and buried information in our unconscious memories that I don't want to really go into any kind of like Freudian repression or anything, because that's not really very scientific. But there's definitely memories that upon like meditation or going into these altered states, we could bring out some of this information that was in our subconscious. And people may mistake that for new information that they never had. But usually this information is information that they once had, and it's kind of like accessing a memory as opposed to accessing something completely new, like the quick solution to global warming or something.
Yeah, and this brings up another point that, you know, meditation can be dangerous. Not just because if you practice the wrong meditation technique, you know, it can program you with religious indoctrination and stuff like that, but because, you know, sometimes people aren't ready to access that deeper information, you know, and so it's important for people to be aware of that, you know, meditation is not for everyone. I mean, the general rule is meditation is good for healthy people, you know, and, you know, we're all unhealthy to a certain extent, you know, we've all been hurt and, you know, have psychological things that could be helped.
Yeah, yeah. So, Mark, how does your idea of spirituality differ at all, if it does, from Sam Harris's?
The one place where we differ is he, I think, and I may be wrong, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing what I thought I read in his book, but I think he went to Dharamsala and he learned from a Tibetan guru. But I think he did have a teacher that transmitted information to him. I never experienced that on purpose, because I didn't want to owe anything to a guru. I didn't want to, you know, learn from a guru. When I was in Dharamsala, I stayed away from, you know, entering into that relationship. You know, the reason I'm against it is because, judging from history, people think that they have a good guru and then they wind up drinking Kool-Aid at the end, you know, and so that's why I'm against gurus.
Right. Yeah, literally, too.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, this has been great. We have to wrap it up. So why don't you kind of finish by telling us where people can get more information about meditation? Let's say, all right, Mark, you sold me. I want to explore this a little bit more. So what do I do now?
Well, we're building a website. It's not quite up yet, but it's skepticsguidetomeditation.com. And I can be found at markwgura, that's GURA.com. And the easy way to remember my name is just think of anti-guru, because I'm very anti-guru. I don't believe in gurus. So think of guru with an A at the end, that's gura, right? And I'm also on Facebook and stuff, and I look forward to talking more about this subject.
All right, awesome.
Very nice. Mark, thank you so much for being here. This was really, really interesting.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Thank you all. Have a great one.
All right, that was Mark W. Gura. What did you think, Kim?
I'm really intrigued. I actually, ever since Eat, Pray, Love, which I read that book, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, maybe 10, I don't even remember when it came out, but it was just a really interesting concept to me as to something new to try. But he actually made some really good scientific points as to why there would be actual benefits to someone who wasn't what I would call spiritual, that secular spirituality idea. I think it's interesting. What about you?
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm always a little skeptical whenever you hear the word spirituality, but I think Mark really does have a full secular slant to it, and he does count on the science to back it up. I hear so much about it, like being in the field of psychology, so much about meditation and mindfulness, and I have tried it before. It just doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. He and I talked about this when the last conference, I think it was at the Atheist Alliance of America in Atlanta, and he said they actually a lot of times suggest that you do a 10-day retreat first to learn really how to do it right, and that actually tends to be, now I hope I'm not misspeaking here, but I think he said it tends to be more effective that way rather than, you know, starting small and going into a 10-day, actually starting with the 10-day helps you with the smaller bits. So that was interesting to me as well.
That is interesting. I just wonder how many people would devote that kind of time to it. And I hear, like Mark even mentioned, like 10 hours a day, 14 hours a day, just like sitting completely silent. I just don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I'd want to do that.
From a really, really shallow standpoint, what really intrigues me most is if I had the ability, if I tried this and had the ability to calm myself down and turn my brain off at the end of the day without a margarita, I'm like, well, that would save me like 200 calories a day.
That's right. Yeah, so you got some immediate benefit there.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. All right, listeners, if you have feedback for us, you can email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.